Herzlich willkommen zur dieswöchigen Ausgabe der Woche mit Stefan und Stefan. Mein Name ist Stefan Mauer und normalerweise rede ich an dieser Stelle mit Stefan Dörner. In dieser Woche werdet ihr aber uns beide relativ wenig zu hören bekommen, denn sie besteht aus einem Interview, das ich mit meinem guten Freund Dave Buschel aus Australien geführt habe. Er wohnt in der Nähe von Melbourne und hat mit mir darüber geredet, wie die No-Covid-Strategie in Australien funktioniert, wie es sich anfühlt, dabei zu sein und wie man dort überhaupt dorthin gekommen ist. Das war nämlich auch alles andere als nicht schmerzhaft. Das Ganze ist auf Englisch. Ich hoffe, das ist okay für euch. Wir haben jetzt nicht den öffentlich-rechtlichen Weg gewählt und da irgendwelche Übersetzungen oder sowas hintergetan. Ich hoffe, wir sprechen deutlich genug. Es ist jedenfalls extrem interessant und gibt einem nochmal so ein bisschen Einblick da rein, wie es halt auch gehen kann. Am neidischsten wurde ich tatsächlich während des Gesprächs, als er mir erzählt hat, dass er in 2 Wochen Konzerttickets hat und dort auch hingehen wird. Nun aber genug der Vorrede. Viel Spaß beim Interview. Wir sind gespannt, was das mit eurer Meinung zur No-Covid-Strategie macht. As I said, I'm now connected with my good friend Dave from Melbourne. We haven't actually talked in quite a while. We just wrote and texted a lot. So it's really, really cool to hear your voice again. And thanks so much for taking the time to explain your no-COVID strategy to us. Hi, Dave.
Yeah, hi, Stefan. Guten Morgen to you and guten Abend for mich. That's about as much German as I'll be able to do on this chat today. It's definitely to speak about epidemiology and COVID. I have no German for that.
Well, that's true, but don't sell yourself short. I mean, your German is actually really good, but we'll do this in English. I think that's a little bit easier. Also, I mean, we all learned a lot of new words last year when it comes to the pandemic.
Absolutely.
So you're living in Melbourne, and since quite a while, you don't have a lot of new COVID cases. Actually, right now, I think you're at 0, right?
Yeah, so I'm living in Melbourne in Australia, so that's in the state of Victoria, and that's important for this story that I live in Victoria. And currently we have, I think, no active cases in the state, and we've had 8 consecutive days of no active cases, and that follows a period of very low cases since about November. So since November, it's been mostly 0 daily cases, and then with the odd kind of, you know, just before Christmas or just before New Year's, there was a couple, and then there were a couple 2 weeks ago or something like that again. So there's small blips, but generally we have 0 daily cases and no more active cases, I think, as of today.
So does that mean that you have a lot more freedom than we, for example, have in Germany? We are still in some kind of lockdown here. Or does that mean you're still extremely cautious?
Both. So I think we have a lot of freedom again, and we are still also very cautious. What are the restrictions at the moment? I think you can have 30 people to your house, and you can have about 200 people for public gatherings. So at a pub, there's no face mask restrictions unless you go to a shopping center or a supermarket or you're in a taxi. So there are still some rules and there are still limits on things. But I don't know, Stefan, how often you have 30 people at your house. It doesn't really impact me. You know, I've got 2 young children, so it doesn't really impact me that much that I'm limited to 30 people. I rarely have 10. And then in 2 days, the football starts again, and that will be at 50% capacity. So our biggest stadium will be able to have 50,000 people in 2 days' time.
Oh, wow. I remember how we visited a football game in, I think, 2012 together.
Correct. Yeah.
And you made me eat a meat pie, right?
Yeah.
So you'll be able...
I think we forced you to be a Magpie supporter after that game.
So you'll be able to do that again, just with a limited number of people.
Correct.
And you can go shopping, you can go to work, all that's possible in Melbourne.
Shopping and everything is open. Pubs and things are open. There's just limits on the amount of people you can have in the shops and in the pubs, and the contact tracing, like the QR code check-in, that's mandatory for everything. And then work, the offices, the maximum is 75% of office capacity. But I think with the shift to work from home now, everyone's struggling to get 75% of people back into the office. Although I personally miss it very much and I'm trying to get there again. So it feels normal, but people are still very, very cautious all the time. It's not like it's gone away.
Yeah, of course. And I'm sure there's also a lot of screening at the airports and other places where you can enter the country, right?
Well, you can't actually really enter the country. You can't, it's very difficult to leave the country. I work for an international NGO, so our staff are used to flying to Africa or to Asia or to Pacific countries, small islands, and working there. And it's very hard for them to do that. And if you want to come into Australia, unless you're Tom Hanks or Novak Djokovic, it's very difficult to do that. So there is an issue at the moment where there's about 25,000 Australian citizens who can't get back into Australia and haven't been able to for about 12 months. We've pretty much closed our borders for a year.
Okay. So even if I thought, it's so great that these guys have no COVID, I'd like to visit Dave, I couldn't right now.
I mean, not really. So we have, very small numbers of international plane arrivals. And if you did arrive here, it's mandatory 2-week quarantine in a hotel. And that is the biggest risk for Australia. It's the hotel quarantine. So cases that come in from overseas, and then, you know, there's a security guard who works in the hotel and he contracts COVID, and then he goes out into the town, gets a pizza, and that's how it kicks off. So that's basically the risk, that is where our risk lies.
I think it's really, really interesting to talk about that, like how this is perceived in everyday life. Because if I compare it to Germany, we have rising cases again. Everybody is talking about how we are entering a third wave of COVID, and everybody's saying, well, a few cases, those are okay. It's not that dangerous. We've got to get used to living with the virus, blah, blah, blah. But when I hear you talk, it's like, okay, one security guy, he contracts it. That's a huge risk.
Yeah.
So was that always the priority, to like really make sure nobody contracts it? Or was that something that was achieved over time? Like, how was the perception at the beginning of the pandemic in March and April last year?
I had to read back over this in advance of having this conversation, and it was kind of interesting because, you know, the year has been such a blur for everybody, regardless of whether you have zero cases or not. It's been so intense. So how did it get to that point? That's hard. So maybe I'll come at this question a different way. Australia has never publicly had a strategy of elimination. So the strategy it's never been about getting to zero COVID. It's always been about suppression and trying to keep it as low as possible. But then with that, having it as low as possible is a really low tolerance for it. So if you have one case, suddenly there's press conferences, there's, you know, people want to know what's happening, there's talk of restrictions, you know, suddenly you're watching the news again every day, every morning at 11 a.m. to check, you know, how many cases today. And that's how it starts. So there is very, very low tolerance for that stuff. How we got to that point, I think it was just learning over time that if you wanted to get through this, you had to be really, really aggressive. And I think Australia was in a fortunate position because we have only sea borders, we can close our borders to things. So as I mentioned, the biggest risk is by far international arrivals coming into the country. And the risk is then it jumps from the hotel to the community. So if it jumps to the community, that's where the lockdowns start to happen at the community level. If they happen at the hotel level, that's okay. There's usually about three or four or five or six hotel cases a day. That's fine. It's when it jumps that's where that problem lies. And I think it probably took us a little while to understand that. So we've had two lockdowns. We've had two waves. They don't compare anything to what Europe, the UK or the US has gone through. You'll laugh. The first lockdown was at a peak of 110 cases a day. Even our second lockdown was at a peak of 725 cases a day. The first lockdown was all international cases, all international arrivals pretty much. And then the second lockdown was then triggered by it getting out of the hotels. The first wave, we didn't really appreciate that it was all hotel arrivals. And then it was clear in the second wave that that is where the risk was. So it was a learning process.
So for you, it's clear it's the international arrivals that pose the biggest risk.
Absolutely.
So do you think it wouldn't have been possible without this opportunity to close all the borders? Because like if I compared Australia and Germany, when it comes to that, there probably couldn't be more opposite countries, because Germany is landlocked except for a little bit of sea in the north. And we have 9 different countries bordering to Germany. And that's always what people say when they talk about a no-COVID strategy for Germany. They say that, well, look at New Zealand, look at Australia, they can do this, they have no land borders, so they can close. Just so I understand this right, you do sometimes let people in the country, but then it's really strict, like, okay, they have to go to a hotel, they have to quarantine for 14 days, and you monitor every day if any cases get out, right?
Correct. So it's pretty rigid. So yes, we can close the borders, but you know, if it gets if the community transmission happens, then it doesn't matter if you've closed the borders because it's in the community. What happens when the community transmission happens is, like I say, that's when the lockdowns happen. So yes, we have an advantage in terms of being able to close the borders, and that is something that, you know, Europe, you'd have to like throw away the Schengen agreement basically and go, we're going to close our borders, you know, and it would be, not every country would do it and it would be crazy. But then we're very strict on the hotel quarantine. So the UK, for example, which is also an island, is not in the same position with the size of its population that it could close the borders. It's not realistic for them to do that. But the fact that they did not have hotel quarantine for such a long time and then brought it in so late, it was almost no longer relevant at that point. That was weird to just see from Australia's perspective, because we knew it worked, like it helped, you know, it gave you a buffer. You could monitor this stuff.
Are you aware that we don't do that in Germany?
Oh, you guys do so many other good things, though.
Yeah, but we don't do the hotel quarantine. And we actually, right now, we are recording on Tuesday, 16th of March. Right now, as of yesterday, as of Monday, we stopped vaccination with the AstraZeneca vaccine because of a really tiny fraction of
blood clot
cases. And people are going nuts over this. Yep. We don't have a quarantine for the people who come back. And we even allowed now to fly to Mallorca, which is like the German destination for a vacation in the Mediterranean.
Fantastic.
And there were news that weekend that there were hundreds of extra flights because of the high demand of people who want to fly there. And when I compare this and I look at what you guys are doing, how strict you are, and actually how strict you have to be to get this thing under control, and then I compare it to what we're doing here, I wouldn't say we're doing that much.
Look, if I was making a joke, it's the opposite of the stereotype, isn't it? Everyone would expect Germany to be very strict and rigid about it, and everyone would expect Australia to go, oh, whatever, mate, you'll be right, we'll be fine, don't worry. And it's the opposite of that. Look, I think if you allow free movement around Europe, I think hotel quarantine is not going to have the same degree of impact that it would have here. It doesn't matter. You can't have free movement and hotel quarantine at the same time. In Europe, I don't know how you can do that. So I think Germany faces a different situation. What is interesting, though, is probably the social aspect of it. So I know in other conversations you and I have had about the resistance that people have to preventative measures to prevent COVID, social distancing, mask wearing, restrictions, gathering limits, all that stuff. We love it.
What do you mean, that people in Australia are happy they're restricted?
No, we're not, of course we're not happy about it, but again, I think there's a stereotype about Australians that they are very rebellious people, right? That we don't respect authority, and that's like, I'm going to let you in on a secret to anybody listening to this. That is not remotely true. Australians love authority. Australians love being told what to do. Australians love a rule. If you tell somebody, hey, you have to sign that thing before you go to the back of the line, they'll go, oh, okay, sorry, and go back and sign the piece of paper and then go back to the line and then go, did I do it right? So when the restrictions came in, people just followed them. And yes, there were elements of the population that would protest and complain about it, but it was pretty clear that that was a fringe group of people who were, you know, didn't get it or were missing the point. I mean, if your issue is freedom, I think we're all in a pretty good situation now. The freedoms have come back now. I could have got tickets to a music concert on the weekend. I'm going to one in a few weeks, you know, like, yep, there'll be fewer crowds and everything, but compared to the rest of the world, that's a beautiful place to be in.
Yes, for sure. I mean, I don't even know when the next concert or public performance will be that I'll be able to watch. Because right now, as I said, we have rising cases again. I mean, we've been in some kind of lockdown for more than 4 months. Wow. By now.
Yeah.
And I remember how we texted, I think it was back in September or October last year, when you texted me, oh, I just got out of a 7-week straight lockdown and it was really tough on everyone. But now we are finally emerging somehow. I don't know exactly when that was.
Yeah, so our longest lockdown at the time. So last year, the lockdown in Victoria here was the longest one in the world. It was the strictest and the longest, and it went for about 122 days, I think.
Oh, so it was even more than 7 weeks?
Yeah. Yeah. I think when I messaged you, we were starting to come out of, like, it was easing out. But again, they had a very strict criteria on how they would get out and how they would ease it, and it would be done progressively. And even when our average was 5 cases a day, they didn't ease it. They still kept us in lockdown when there were 5 cases a day. So the day it got to zero, that was a big day.
We're talking about active cases, not new cases, right?
No. So that came first. Zero new cases. So when there were five new cases a day, they didn't ease the lockdown. Then when it got to zero cases, it had to be zero cases for about 14 days, right? Zero new cases for 14 days because, you know, the theory is that COVID takes 14 days to incubate, etc. So we had to have zero cases for 14 consecutive days before, like, it was really opened up again.
Okay, wow. And that was after about 110 days of lockdown.
Yep.
Right?
Correct.
And so when we talk about lockdown, there are very different ways this is done all over the world. And just to get a clearer picture about what happened in Australia, what were the strictest measures that you guys had to go through in the lockdown?
It's interesting, isn't it? Because I remember right at the beginning of this talking to you, and you said, this is going to be really bad. And it was the first time I called you in a long time. You said to me, this is going to be really bad. There are limits to how close people can be in the queue at the supermarket. You know, everyone's wearing a face mask, and Australia's got about 2 weeks. And I said, no, this is crazy. Thinking of that conversation now, I'm like, how naive were we? So at the strongest point of our lockdown, you could not go further than 5 kilometers from your house. There was a curfew from 8 in the evening till 8 in the morning or something like that, I think, or 6 in the morning. All the schools were closed. All the daycare centers were closed. Kindergartens were closed. Everyone worked from home. You could not go out to eat. You could only leave your house for 4 reasons, to do shopping, to do exercise a maximum of twice a day. So you could only exercise twice a day within 5 kilometers. You had to wear a mask outside, absolutely. They would fine you about $500 if you didn't have a mask. If you had to provide caregiving services, and then I think that was it. There were only 4 reasons why you're allowed to leave the house.
So even businesses, production, everything was stopped?
Yeah, I mean, you could still get the mail. Essential services, home deliveries, the post, supermarkets, cafes would do takeaway, but everything else was, basically everything else was stopped, yeah.
Okay, because when I compare it to what we have now, we always had some kind of easing of the rules at some point. Like right now, we are talking about having shops where you can still go in as long as the new cases aren't too high and there's like a restriction on how many people per how many meters of square foot area and stuff like that. Schools are open again. And the production, like all the car companies and everyone, they've never stopped producing except during the first lockdown in March and April. So this is all still going on. And it looks to me and sounds to me like your lockdown was much stricter than the one we are experiencing right now. And it was apparently even almost as long. I mean, we are now doing this since about a little more than 4.5 months, actually.
Yeah, that's right. So what is the strictest, and forgive me, what is the strictest that you have been at in this 4 months?
In these 4 months, actually, it wasn't as strict as in March and April. Then we actually had a lot of production closed down, most of the offices closed, schools were closed, but there was no curfew, there was no area around the home, which you had to stay inside. But during the first lockdown, we actually managed to get cases down very quickly. And I think that's the huge difference between Australia and Germany. When we had declining cases, like quickly declining cases, we stopped the lockdown before the cases were close to zero. The weather was getting better at this time of the year in Germany. And we somehow had this narrative, okay, we can't get rid of it 100% anyways. So let's just try to somehow keep it not too high. And that's where I think the strategies of the countries really differ, because I don't know if that was after the first wave in Australia, but then it was always very clear or made very clear to you that no, our goal is not to just somehow live with the virus, because that's something they say here all the time, but your goal is to really get it under control and get rid of it.
Correct. So it's always been about getting the level as low as you possibly could. They never say elimination. It's just very low tolerance. It's suppression. Suppression is the word that they use. I think it worked. So there's a difference here. So Victoria is the one state that this happened to. This was not the country. So if you lived in Queensland or New South Wales or South Australia or Western Australia, it's like COVID doesn't even exist, right? So it's only in Victoria that this lockdown happened. This wasn't the whole country. It was just my state.
And how come this was only local? I mean, isn't that a thing that happens all over the country?
Yeah, so Victoria maybe didn't have its contact tracing and hotel quarantine system as tight as some of the other states did in the beginning, and it escaped. And I think we didn't appreciate how contagious it would be. And then that's where it kind of suddenly escalated from, you know, 100 cases on a Monday to 720 cases a day on the Friday. Like it just went bang, really fast. So there's a lot of questions around what happened in Victoria that made Victoria slip. There's only really three states that take international arrivals at the moment. And so there's a big inquest into why that happened. And there's been a lot of improvements made now. But within Australia, the first lockdown that happened in March, April, the whole world went through that lockdown, I think. That was Australia-wide. The second lockdown that we had was only Victoria. So there are other states that have not really had a second wave. They've only had one a year ago. It's interesting now because there's a divide in the country between Victorians who got through it and other states who don't understand what it is that we did because they never really had it. So you speak to people who work in Queensland and they're like, you're just working from home now because that's what you can do. And I'm like, no, I can't go into the office. And we're exhausted because 4 months of the strictest lockdown in the world, it's this combination of being very, very tired and possibly traumatized as a group of people from doing that. And I say this having not faced the same amount of illness and death as the other parts of the world, but the lockdown, the psychological effects of the lockdown of being 5K radius, four reasons to leave the house, and that really being followed, there's a huge sense of pride that it worked, that no one else in the world has really done that, but then that the rest of the country doesn't understand us either. So, you know, it's like, wow, we're really proud of ourselves and everyone else are idiots. So,
see, I think this is really interesting as well, because, I mean, we just talked about Australia only having sea borders, but also the virus didn't escape to other parts of your country from.
So this is where the low tolerance becomes a problem. Right? Because the second there's a case, all the states just bring up their borders to each other. So So my father and my partner's parents live in Queensland. So that's two states away. So that's we're a big country. We're the size of the continental United States. So, you know, for me to fly to Queensland, that's 2 hours on a plane. We're meant to see them in 2 weeks. And if there's going to be like three cases in Queensland or three cases in Victoria, they will bring up the borders and we won't be able to travel. Western Australia had one case in hotel quarantine that got out, one, and they shut the whole state down for 5 days. One case.
Oh, wow. And so the whole state went to a lockdown after one case got out.
Correct. Yeah.
So what does that do with you and the people there? I mean, I just imagine I'm a security guard in the hotel and I know if I contracted it and I don't realize it and I carry it out of here, I'll be the reason for a whole state to go into lockdown. Isn't that what happens in your head?
Stressful, huh? Yeah, hope no one finds out who you are. yeah, that's what would happen. But the problem is that it's not always consistent. It's not like if Victoria suddenly got one case, then we would shut down the whole state. You know, all the states are a bit different in how much tolerance they have for the virus. And it's very low and it's inconsistent and it's dealt with on a case-by-case basis. So trying to plan anything interstate becomes very, very difficult. So I only know one state in Germany. So Westphalia, is that a state? That's a state,
almost.
Right?
Almost. North Rhine-Westphalia.
North Rhine-Westphalia, that's it. So yeah, you know, imagine if they somehow put up their borders and locked themselves away from the rest of Germany. That's kind of what it's like here. It's pretty weird. So there's been situations where, particularly over Christmas, everyone traveled for holidays and to see their families, and they went to another state. And then suddenly there was, because it was Christmas and New Year's, there was a spike of cases. And then people would have 24 hours notice to suddenly turn around and have to drive back home as quickly as they could and race back across the border before it closed, because they only give you about 24 hours notice when that happens.
So how do people cope with that? Is it something you appreciate and say, well, it sucks, but we still at least know that our government is taking care that this thing doesn't get out of hand? Or is it rather something where people are annoyed and say, by now, well, we have so few cases, can we please just get a little more freedom of movement?
Yeah, it's a bit of both. I mean, when people say we have to live with coronavirus, I think that's true to an extent, except we have to live with it once people are vaccinated. Living with it doesn't mean letting it go absolutely crazy, right? Living with it means going, it exists, we are vulnerable to it, and we have to work out how to get through it in the best way that we can. And that's different to every context, obviously. You know, we met in India, you know, you think of the population density in India. How are you going to do anything? How can you socially distance in that context? It's impossible. So every context is different. But I think sometimes I wish we weren't as scared of it as we are, even though the fact that we've been that scared or that intolerant of it has meant that we have succeeded in the way that we have. It would be good to know, okay, these are the thresholds for traveling. These are the thresholds for economic activity. These are the thresholds for the borders being reopened or closed or whatever they might be. But I think as it is right now, everyone's going to rely on the vaccine. We have the ability to produce, I know it's a bad name in Germany at the moment, but we can produce the AstraZeneca vaccine locally.
Well, I wouldn't generally say a bad name, but yeah, it has really, really bad press here right now. And I honestly don't know how that got so much out of hand. We actually talked about this on the last episode of our podcast as well. And we both said, and many people we know said, of course we wouldn't hesitate a second. And of course we would get ourselves vaccinated with that. Actually, when you talk about this vaccine, I read like a week or two ago that Italy stopped the export of, I think, 250,000 AstraZeneca doses to Australia. Was that on the news in Australia as well?
Yeah, it was. But we've only just started our vaccination program. It's brand new. Like it's only 3 or 4 weeks old. So I think, and the vaccination rollout is very, very slow. Again, we're being really cautious with it. Like all the approvals for Pfizer and AstraZeneca and Novavax or whatever they all are, We've been quite slow compared to the rest of the world in approving them. I don't know that anybody knew anybody that had been vaccinated yet that was going to be affected by this blockage from Italy. Also, when the numbers are as low as they are, you know, there's a sense sometimes that there's not a desperate need for the vaccine just at the moment. So, you know, one of the strategies Australia has is to kind of see how it goes in the other countries first, make sure it is okay, make sure that it doesn't induce a rage virus or whatever happens in the horror movies, right? Because that's how it works. We rush production of a vaccine and then suddenly there's zombies. That's my understanding of how this scenario happens.
I love it that you can finally use your expertise as a zombie expert. Yeah.
That's it. I'm not a doctor, Stefan.
Only one way to interpret that. Only zombies are possible.
Correct. So I think, yeah, it was a story for a little bit, but it was more about why the EU would allow that to happen than it is about what is our impact to us.
I also imagine in a country where you have so few cases, you're not really worried about this amount of doses. It's just a political thing, right?
Correct.
I mean, we are discussing right now, apparently in the US, there are millions, like dozens of millions of doses of AstraZeneca, which aren't being used because they haven't approved it yet, but they also refused to export it. And there were even offers like, if you could give us these doses now, you'll get them back as soon as you approve the vaccine. You get it from our production, but they also refuse this. So this is a huge discussion in Germany as well. And funny thing is that even weeks before this discussion started, the EU started it itself by not exporting to Australia. So that's something that I found very strange, to see these two things come together.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it? I mean, the fact that this is a thing that everybody on the planet wants, right? And there's very few people who don't, who are like, oh no, the vaccine, damn, right? I mean, maybe I shouldn't be surprised. Maybe I shouldn't be so naive. The fact that it just gets ruined by bureaucracy and all the rest of that stuff, you know, it's like every human needs this. Just flood it out already. But at the same time, it's the fastest development of a vaccine in human history. So maybe there would be some hurdles and some bumps and things along the way.
No, one second. You just said everybody wants it. But if I look at Germany, we actually have a significant number of people here who are saying they don't want to get vaccinated. So is that an issue in Australia as well? Or no, not at all?
Yes, it is. And I think there's probably 70% across the board, like we'll get it. And then there's probably 3% that are definitely not. And then everyone else is somewhere in between that. But I think broadly, it's a large acceptance of it. And the more that people get it and see that it's safe, I think that 70% number will go up. But there's not a vocal anti-vax presence. Although I live up in the woods, in the forest here in Melbourne. And I did run into a bunch of anti-vaxxers in the woods. I was taking my kids out for a walk.
What now? In the woods?
In the woods, in the forest.
What were they doing in the forest?
It was like a grim fairy tale, you know. Hansel and Gretel and their dad were going for a walk, and suddenly they came across a gingerbread house, and inside the gingerbread house were five anti-vaxxers.
What were they doing? Like, were they on a protest or something?
No, they were with their children. They were playing with their children and they were complaining about how the anti-5G people make them look bad.
Okay, so they weren't protesting. You just talked to them and during the conversation, you somehow discovered they don't want to get vaccinated.
Yeah, so, you know, I take my children to the park sometimes. And, you know, if you're a dad and you take your kids to the park, there's always a group of mothers that are taking their children to the park and the mothers don't talk to you because you're a dad. They think that you haven't done that.
This is how it is in Australia, yeah?
This is how it is being a parent, Stefan. And, you know, all our children were kind of playing together. And then this was at the peak of the lockdown. All our children were kind of playing together. And then one of the women greeted her other friend with a hug. And I noticed that and I went, that's weird. You don't really see people hugging at the moment. And her friend went, oh, can I hug you? Is that okay? And the other woman went, oh, just hug me. It's not like this is real anyway. And I sort of went, oh, this is interesting. So I kind of just started eavesdropping on them. yeah, they were just talking about how the media makes them look like crazy people, and the 5G people are undermining their message, and they wish the 5G people would go away. And the whole time I'm looking at their kids playing with my kids, and I'm like, yeah, kids, stay away from them. Would you please just don't get your fingers out of their mouth? Just come on.
Sorry, that was during the lockdown.
That was during the lockdown.
You were still allowed to let your children go out and play on playgrounds also together.
I realized as I said that, what I'd actually done was I'd taken them to a field in the middle of the forest where nobody could really see because we needed to get out of the house. It was a bit of a small illegal thing on my part. But I didn't realize that I'd run into an anti-vaxxer meeting at the same time.
That's definitely something you wouldn't expect in the middle of the woods. But if you look back now, you had this really, really strict lockdown, and you also said this really took a toll on the psyche of many people. Would you still say it was worth it? Like, are you happy that your government made you go through this, especially when you look at other countries, how we are struggling? Or would you say these were for such difficult months, I don't think anything is worth going through that? Like, what's your opinion on that?
I think it was worth it, although that answer is not complete yet. If there's another outbreak and it loses all control, and we can't bring it back under control, or we have to go into a bigger one. The lockdown we were in was as strict as we could go into, really. So if you were in another one of those for longer, then it wouldn't be worth it. It's worth it if it means that the vaccine rolls out okay, and we don't have to go through that again. Then it was absolutely worth it. At the same time, though, you want to kind of appreciate what you have at the time that you have it, too. So in this moment today, the fact that I could go on a holiday 2 weeks ago with my partner to the beach, yes, that makes it worth it.
That's definitely something we can't really think about here, except the people who are flying to Mallorca right now. I mean, we had the starting point for our second outbreak. Well, I would say at least its origin was already in the summer when we had so many people travel through the world and Europe and then coming back. And we tested them, many of them, at the airport, but many people slipped through. We didn't have a mandatory quarantine, at least not one that was enforced. And you can see in the numbers, which are published every day in Germany, that during that time, the infections that were imported from abroad really went through the roof. And many people said this was the origin of our second wave. So it's really interesting to see that compared to what you're saying. You're saying you can't get in or out of the country since 12 months. And that's something people here are saying. We couldn't sell that to people. We couldn't make them do that.
People have adapted, I think. Definitely over 4 months. It's a long enough lockdown that you adapt to it. When they lifted the restrictions, it's not like everybody ran out and had a party. It's not like everyone is suddenly going to barbecues with lots of people, you know. I mean, people are out and doing things and all the rest of it, but the mood is not a celebratory one. It's a cautious mood. You know, yes, there are some parties and there are bars you can go to and people are dancing and things, but people are still being really careful with all that sort of stuff. And I think we just adapted to it for a while, and it's going to take us a while to adapt back to that being the normal, like that you can do those things. If you'd said a year ago that that was how you were going to feel, again, you'd have no concept of that. You have no way of conceiving it. Sorry, it's hard to kind of reflect on, isn't it? Because it kind of almost bends your mind.
Mind bend, like that. Maybe that's the right expression for it. Because on the one hand, if you're young, your risk seems to be manageable. But on the other hand, this thing really turns the whole society upside down. And so to somehow get your head wrapped around these two things is really difficult. And I think it has a lot to do with communication as well. Like also with communication from the government, which makes you do the lockdowns and everything. That's actually something that I would be really interested in. How is the communication in Australia also that you get from your authorities? Was it always really clear? What are the measures? When and why are they implemented? What is our goal? Because I have the feeling that here in Germany, it's not really made very clear by many. We are just taking it day by day. That's at least how it feels to me.
So it's interesting. I'll talk about Australia first, and then I'll talk about Victoria second. So Australia first, we have a right-wing government in place at the moment at a national level. Some people would say centre-right, other people say right, but whatever. And it was interesting. Australia was one of the few places to, was one of the first places to declare COVID a pandemic. So Australia declared COVID a pandemic before the World Health Organization declared it a pandemic. You would not necessarily expect a right-wing government to do that, nor would you suddenly expect a right-wing government to get its act together for the health of its population. And somehow it did that. Without a doubt, I will never vote for a right-wing government, but if I was ever going to do it, it would be solely on the response of this. They rolled out the biggest economic stimulus package for 100 years in Australia. They were fast to respond to the threat, closing the borders, understanding what needed to happen for social distancing, putting that in place and all the rest of it. And then over time, obviously, that's kind of fragmented, you know, and it's kind of loosened up a bit. But it was very clear, the communication. In Victoria, during the lockdown, during those 4 months, it was crystal clear. So the premier of the state, so the, you know, the guy who's the leader of the political party that's in power in Victoria, his name is Daniel Andrews. He became famous for fronting every news conference every day for every single one of those 122 days. So he did 122 consecutive press conferences every single day. And it was the same message every time from the same person going, get tested. These are the restrictions. Don't break them. We're in a situation that no one's ever faced before. The only thing that we can do, because we have no vaccine for this, the only thing you can do is stay away from other people. He would stay and answer every single journalist question until there were no more questions. So sometimes the press conference would go for 3 hours, and he would do this every day. The way the lockdown worked, it was in stages. We went stricter stages in and then stricter stages out, and it was communicated in advance when that was going to happen, and they didn't really waver on that. Even if it looked like we were ahead of where we were supposed to be, they didn't jump ahead and suddenly go, okay, no, things are actually looking better. Let's just loosen it a little bit because that's what people want. They just went, nah. And just to see that, you know, to watch that as a strategy, as a communication strategy, was really admirable. People called him Dictator Dan because they thought he was being a dictator, and he probably was for 4 months, you know. But like, you're living in a historical moment. Like, maybe sometimes you need a dictator, but not one like in Brazil where they don't think it doesn't exist. You need someone who goes, guys, these are the things that we are now going to do. We are all going to do them. I think that's okay sometimes. It's like Spider-Man, you know, great power comes great responsibility. So sometimes you've all got to lock down a little bit.
And this was something he could just do on the state level? What about the federal level? Wouldn't they have been able to take this power away from him? What was their role?
So there's differences in power of what can happen at the federal and the state level. He declared a state of emergency in the middle of last year sometime. And we still live under that state of emergency now. And what that means is that the medical health officer for Victoria can say, we need to go into lockdown. That's basically what that means. And that the police can enforce it, essentially. And even if we are not in a lockdown, that state of emergency still exists. And the states have control over schools. The states have control over their own borders. The states have control over businesses in that state. And the federal government kind of has higher level jurisdictions. So even though it's a left-wing government in Victoria and a right-wing government nationally, towards the end, when the lockdown got very intense, the right-wing government was kind of attacking the left-wing Victorian government, saying you need to come out of lockdown now, it's been long enough, you need to open the economy, all the rest of it. And his position basically was, if everyone is sick and dying, then there isn't an economy that you need to worry about. So that was his position, and they stuck with it, and you know, he became a cult figure, essentially. Maybe at the end of this podcast you can play that song I sent you, because I think I sent you the press conference and then the song that they sampled. You know, in some quarters he's a folk hero.
I think that's really interesting, because during that time, like during the lockdown, you already said they called him a dictator. And I'm sure the approval rates also weren't that good. But now, after you've managed to get through this and actually have no cases for now, the approval rates are going up. Is it like
I think the approval rates were actually, I think the approval rates were quite high during the lockdown. People hated it, but they understood why it had to happen. And they saw that the numbers were going down from that. And even though it was exhausting and stressful and created issues with domestic violence and created issues with mental health and suicide risk and all that sort of thing, people fundamentally as a society understood that it was the only hope that we had to get through it. I think his approval ratings were actually very high. And the people who were calling him a dictator would have been a very loud minority.
Really cool insights. Thank you so much. And I think, or I feel like we could talk about this for another hour at least. So interesting. But I think for now, at least for the podcast, I don't have any more questions right now, except if there's something you really want to tell us or share with us.
I don't know that this, how Australia has done it or Victoria has done it, works in every context. You know, I understand why Europe would struggle. It makes sense. There's, you know, a lot of countries, porous borders. It would be so hard to manage. I don't understand why England, for instance, has been the way it has, though. The US, I mean, well, it's obvious why they are in the situation they're in. But I think it's context specific. You can't look at Australia or New Zealand and go, we should all just do what they're doing. At the same time, though, the sacrifice, if you attack it aggressively, does actually pay off. But I think that's maybe a point that should have been made 9 months ago. I think maybe now, do you think there's any choice but to live with it until the vaccine rolls out? I mean, what do you do now? It's, you know, the numbers are so big.
Well, we are vaccinating people in Germany, but very, very slowly. And it's working so far. The vaccinated people get sick way less than everybody else. But we are way too slow. Like, we have less than 10% of the population vaccinated right now. Most of the vaccines also need two jabs. So fully vaccinated, we are even below 5%, I think. So we kind of had this hope around Christmas, when the first vaccines were approved, that by the end of March or so, we would be through with the worst. But as far as it looks now, cases are going up again because of the mutations. They're running wild. Even though we are still in some kind of lockdown, cases are rising. So it's really, really late now to do anything close to what you guys did. But I think there are still things we could have done. For example, the hotel quarantine for people who move in. We could have done way better testing at the borders. We could have done way better rapid testing, which we are just rolling out. I mean, the technology for that was there several months ago, and we are just sorting it out now. So there are a lot of things that we could have done better than we are doing right now. And also, I think a huge aspect of everything also that you told me about is communication. I mean, if there's someone really standing there every day and saying, yes, I know the measures are hardcore, but we all know what we have to do and we all know why we have to do them, and I'm here and I'll answer every question you have about this, I think that's a very different approach than our government has right now. Because really, seriously, you hardly see anybody from the higher ranks commenting on the day-to-day measures we are having here.
Yeah, you have to get everyone on board. And there's an expression in Australia that says go hard or go home. If you're going to do a lockdown, that's why you have to do it. You have to go hard at it. You know, like I read about it in England and it's like, oh, they're locking down, but you can still like go to the pub until 11 o'clock. And I'm like, that's not a lockdown. That's just some restrictions and it's not going to work. So you have to basically stop your society for a short period of time. It's about whether now, though, this long into it, where the appetite is for that now. I just feel really lucky. I can't speak for Germany. I can't speak for Europe. I just feel lucky to have been in a place where for that period of time, we got it right. I'm not even saying we'll get it right in the future. Just for that period of time, we got it right.
I don't think I could find any better closing remarks than that. So thank you so much for taking the time to talk about this. And it was really, really cool seeing you again and talking to you again after such a long time. So thanks again. And I really hope it won't take another few years for us until we can talk to each other in person again.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for inviting me. I'm glad you felt that there was a story in Australia that was worth sharing. So I feel very lucky to have been asked. So that's cool. And then the fact that I get to reconnect with you is obviously brilliant. I would love to, you know, I've got family in Germany too. I'd love to get over there and see them and catch up with you and likewise get them over here. It will happen.
For sure. Well, first of all, let's just all get through this pandemic one way or the other. And then hopefully we can make that happen. Thank you so much again, Dave.
No worries, Stefan. Thank you.
So, das war's schon für diese Woche. Ich danke euch allen wie immer sehr fürs Zuhören und weise auf unsere E-Mail hin, die da lautet post@stefanstefan.de. Der erste Stefan mit PH, der zweite mit F. Wie immer könnt ihr uns gerne auch auf den unterschiedlichen Podcast-Plattformen bewerten. Da freuen wir uns über eure Meinung und über Feedback. Und dann bleibt mir nur noch, euch eine schöne Woche zu wünschen. Bleibt gesund und bis bald. Ciao.